And it's remarkable how many companies are so internally focused on how do we do the right thing for the business? How do we build the things we want to build without ever really spending enough time with our customers to know what do your customers want from you in the first place and what's most important to them?
Excellence, professionalism, innovation, and collegiality. These are the values the Sam M. Walton College of Business explores in education, business, and the lives of people we meet every day. I'm Matt Waller, Dean of the Walton College, and welcome to the Be Epic podcast.
I have with me today Josh Smith, who is CEO of Metova, and Jonathan Sassy, who is the Chief Strategy Officer. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, Josh, would you mind telling us a little bit about Metova?
Sure. Yeah. So Metova was founded in 2006, really around developing mobile applications. And at that time, really BlackBerry and Palm were mobile. And so for the past 17 years, we've continued to, you know, lean into mobile and have expanded beyond not just Franklin, Tennessee, where we started, but we're, you know, throughout the U.S. and in Latin America, doing all sorts of things mobile, but then also digital transformation, digital technology partner to large corporations.
And Jonathan, I know you have you're the Chief Strategy Officer. What does that mean? What do you focus on as Chief Strategy Officer?
Well, a lot of the companies that we work with are at some point of a pivot in their strategy, their roadmap. They're facing some kind of transformation. Typically, it's not in their DNA to do that, especially if it's leaning into technology that they don't understand. So a lot of what I do is working with those companies, the senior stakeholders, to better define what their customers need from them, what their capabilities are, and what their roadmap should probably look like in order to deliver on that.
I see, Josh, you know, you're in Bentonville.
That's right.
But the company, didn't it start in Little Rock?
Company started in Franklin, Tennessee.
Oh, Franklin, Tennessee, okay.
Yeah, that's where the original founder was from. And then a gentleman from Arkansas acquired it back in like 2010 or 11. And that's when we began to have an Arkansas presence. It's a long road after that. There's been several different transactions that have happened, private equity investors. But this latest iteration, no longer do we have any institutional investors, and we relocated the headquarters to Bentonville.
That's great. And you've been with Metova for almost 10 years at this point.
Yes. Crazy to think, yes.
So tell me a little bit. Now, I know you've had different roles there, but you've been CEO for almost 6 years. Would you tell me a little bit more about your company positioning? I know you where you started. Are there any verticals you focus on more than others?
Yeah, I'll be pitching this to Jonathan here, but it's really fascinating because we've been doing this for so long. And actually, Jonathan and I were originally introduced by the founder of Metova. We both had our own startup companies. Jonathan had Slacker Radio. I had First Orion Privacy Star. We were trying to solve the same problems. But being serial entrepreneurs and being able to work with all these companies for all these years, it makes us kind of industry agnostic. We can go in and learn, you know, how a company makes money, how they lose money, where maybe adjacent revenue opportunities are, who the stakeholders are, who their customers are, and then from there, build out the other product roadmaps and strategies going forward, and then have the development talent to go ahead and deliver on that.
Well, you know, and I've noticed for you, Jonathan, also have been involved with another Arkansas company, First Orion, and I've done a podcast recording with Charles Morgan. Seems like it was a year or two ago. I can't remember exactly, but he's an amazing individual. Are you still engaged with First Orion at all?
Yeah, I do still communicate with them. I'm a big fan of Charles. I've worked with him pretty closely as that company went through a number of transformations as well. So I kind of came in to do very similar things I'm doing at Metova now, which is take a look at the opportunities of the future and try and rewrite the roadmap a little bit. And with Charles's help and with, you know, Jeff Stalnecker and some of the others that were there, we turned that company in a pretty sharp direction in a short amount of time and really created an opportunity for the future. That was a good stretch.
And I noticed that you are on the Forbes Communications Council, so you contribute articles to Forbes, what kind of articles do you write?
A lot of what we focus on is helping people through those transformation challenges. So, you know, when do you do it? How do you do it? What kind of signals do you look for? You know, really trying to give people very specific things to key in on to help them understand when's the right time to invest? Do you need to seek help? You know, are there internal resources you can tap into for that? So really trying to write, you know, a lot of, you know, super helpful content for people that have big decisions to make and are looking for, you know, how do I take the first step in the right direction?
Josh, maybe let's suppose, you know, technology, a lot of times people think of technology as just being something behind the scenes. But technology, the technology that you have and your company can actually affect the brand that you wind up building. Is it hard to get companies to see that and to understand that?
It's a very long process. So I'm not sure who said this, but the best technology is a technology you don't even know you're interacting with it, right? You get, and then the coding part of it, not a lot of people are able to see that. It's not something they can participate in. So when we're working with clients, usually the strategy piece of it and the design, a lot of input goes into that because the customers can, you know, they can see it and can help drive that. And our goal is to really kind of stay focused on what is it's going to drive their business forward and how to do that in the most simple way from a human interface perspective. And then do the hard part with the engineering to make that possible.
And I know that you know, workflows and internal communication patterns and trying to enhance customer experience, you know, a lot of that you can do with the technology you have, but that you develop with your companies. But what about companies that say, look, we need your help here, but there's also existing technologies in these other spaces. Will you help with that as well?
We generally, that is always part of the equation, right? It's usually companies have been up in business for a long time, sometimes 20, 30, 60 years, and are looking to make a transition to digital. Well, they've got a huge investment in that technology stack that they've developed over the years, and you can't just rip and replace it. So it is a very gradual process of identifying what parts of the business can we impact now and what internal systems do we need to leverage to be able to do that, and how do we expose those capabilities to actually make that experience happen. And I remember one client in particular that we had several years ago. First question we asked is, how does a user create an account? And it was all blank stares in the room. As well, they call into customer service, and the customer service person takes the information down. Like, okay, so now we know where we need to start.
Well, you know, Jonathan, when you, it seems like for me at least, so many of the apps I use on my phone, unfortunately, seem like they were created for my computer. But this concept, would you mind speaking a little bit to this concept of mobile first?
Yeah, I mean, the thing with mobile that is interesting when you think of it, if there's everything you do on your phone, your banks, your pizza delivery, whatever it might be, it used to be that as businesses, we would look at other businesses like ours to see what was competitive. You know, if I'm a lawn care company, I look at what the other lawn care companies do. If I sell TVs, I see what the other TV guys are doing. But today, and as to your point, when I go through all the apps on my phone, to me, I'm engaging as a customer in the same universe. And so I have certain expectations I have as I go from app to app to app. I don't care what the other gym apps do, but I know my other apps work really nice and they're really easy to use and I can tap exactly where I want to tap and they're really intuitive. And that's the level of the way that customers are looking at things. Amazon does things a certain way for me. Walmart does certain things for me. Netflix, whatever it might be. And so I have those expectations that every app I use should be able to leverage that technology, the elegance of the design. I have those expectations. So it's a lot easier to be disappointed as a customer too when you open up a new app and you're like, this isn't as good as it should be. And I have that lens I can apply to that because I have 10 other apps that can do that. You know, whether it's telling me when the delivery is going to be made or recommending things I might like or just making it easy to book an appointment. And so we have to be really aware of that as we're designing apps, as we're working with companies and brands to make sure that you might have looked competitively across your landscape to see what everybody else is doing and try and make something as good or maybe even slightly better than that. But you have to realize that your customers are comparing you to the best experiences in the world every
yes,
single day.
Yes, that is right. And you can tell a big difference. I mean, there's some apps you use that you think, this is so intuitive. And others, you know, there was one app I was using not too long ago, and it had pretty good ratings, but it was for keeping track of your time. It's used primarily for consultants, but I like to keep track of my time. Where am I spending my time compared to where should I spend my time? This thing was so unintuitive. I think it's hard to take something that already exists and make it mobile first, if you will.
Yeah, the investment in that is always the challenge because you spend all these resources to get where you are and then you release it to the world and find out that it's not what everybody hoped it would be. And it's very difficult at that point where you start taking a look at your customer experience after you've produced your thing. And that's where, you know, when we talk about, you know, these early strategy sessions with people that we work with, is trying to get through that first before you ever write a line of code, is let's make sure we understand what this experience needs to be so that we don't build a thing that's functionally capable but almost impossible to use.
And then what, you know, and what do your customers use? You've got all that system, the ERP, all that user input. Where are the users spending their time? And elevate those features to the top and maybe push some of those other ones down so it's not so complicated and overwhelming to deal with.
One other thing I'd like to talk to you about, a couple others, but this concept of the Internet of Things. This is still, it was really popular for a while. You don't hear about it as much anymore, but it's maybe more critical now than it used to be. Would you mind speaking to that a little bit?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that's interesting about Internet of Things, to your point, for, you know, 5 years ago, it was a super buzzy term, you know, what crypto and NFTs were maybe last year. And I think what we saw the difference there is Internet of Things today, we interact every day. Everything we touch is something's broadcasting something somewhere, you know, from your vacuum cleaner to your laundry machines to your, you know, refrigerator, whatever it is. Wi-Fi is ubiquitous. We're able to monitor these things, get alerts and stuff. So it's been an interesting pivot in that time where the forecast of the Internet of Things becoming a common everyday occurrence has kind of happened. You know, we connect to thousands of devices, whether we know it or not, you know, throughout the day. And so it's shaping the way we live and work and play in a way that it's become so ubiquitous now that we may not even realize it. And so as we've worked with that, we've enabled businesses who 10, 15 years ago, the tech wasn't there to even try this. And so they weren't even inspired to pivot when the web revolution happened, when the mobile revolution happened. They still didn't need to move. Technology still wasn't actually solving their key problems. And so when you look at something like fleet rentals for like heavy equipment, that's a business that's been on paper and phone calls and literally giant machines, you know, going off into locations where they didn't know where they went or where they were or how they were being used. And that was a project we worked on where you retrofit all these devices with the ability to communicate. And now all of a sudden, I know where every piece of equipment is. I know what state it's in, or, you know, what status it's in. Is it being used? How many hours is it being used? You know, is it been returned on time? If I need to go find it, where is it? You know, so that completely changed their business in a way that technology, you know, changes over the previous 15 years were kind of irrelevant to them. But then it became, we can get rid of all this paper. We can get rid of all this processing. We can find equipment in seconds instead of maybe hours or days. And we're servicing the things that actually need to be serviced, the efficiencies through the roof. It completely changed the trajectory of their business. And that's where we're seeing, you know, on IoT, it's either you have this massive inflection point for companies that suddenly, you know, logistics, shipping, freight, it's massive changes. But down to the smallest thing where I get an alert on my phone that my dryer is completed its cycle. So go get it. And you're like, okay, it's not sitting there for till tomorrow because nobody remembered it was in there. And we just start naturally engaging with these things when we're like, oh, my car has an alert, or my refrigerator tells me that the door was left open or whatever it might be. And we don't really think of that as Internet of Things. We just think of that. That's just modern technology in my world now.
Good point. You know, there's a place that I go on a regular basis that when you enter, you've got to pull out your wallet and show it the barcode. But I've noticed lately, as I'm walking up to this building, it pops up. And so I just click on it, and I thought, wow, that is so nice.
Very handy.
Yes. Now, the fleet is an interesting topic, too, because I read an article, it must have been 10 years ago, I don't remember. It was talking about one of the states in the United States. But they were talking about how many cars were in their fleet. And it talked about how many they didn't know where they were. And they really didn't know at any given point in time where they were, which shocked me. You know, I thought, wow, that's a huge amount of resources that is completely unaccounted for.
That's the glaring problem that gets solved by that, right? You think about just fleets in general, whether it's the cars in California or the trucks in Wisconsin or whatever it might be, is, you know, up until very recently, that's how it was for everybody. Who knows where they are? You know, you might have to call a lot of people to figure out where something is, where today you just pull up your map and, oh, there it is. Like, I know exactly where that is every time.
Well, the pandemic really pushed telehealth forward. And it still is moving forward. And I think it's going to keep growing in the country. Are you all engaged in that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got a variety of healthcare clients, one of which is Innovator Health, that has a very good telehealth platform that's used within the Department of Defense, able to take, you know, compressed video and do, you know, medical procedures out on the battlefield or at high altitude with someone who's on the ground. So I think, you know, what we're seeing on that side of the house, I look forward to seeing it make its way over to the commercial side, because it's talk about time and time wasted as far as, you know, lab results and going to a doctor's office, and all these things could be done much, much faster. And then on the IoT side of the house, our vitals in our body, there's no reason that, you know, a blood pressure cuff once every 6 months probably not giving you the most accurate reading on your personal health.
Well, you know, I have an Oura Ring. The Oura Ring, you know, captures so much data. Like, it captures your average and resting heart rate while you're sleeping, your heart rate variability, which is an important metric, your body temperature, your respiratory rate. You know, it keeps track of your activity. So, you know, how many calories you're burning, the frequency of your workouts, just all kinds of variables. And it also keeps track while you're sleeping of your average oxygen saturation, your breathing regularity. And I thought, well, then you go into the doctor's office once every year or whatever, and they take your blood pressure and weigh you and poke around on you and look in your ears and stuff. And I thought, this is way more valuable than that. I mean, your blood pressure on one reading tells you nothing. You'd think that the medical system would want to be taking this data as well and using it. Maybe they do. I don't know.
I think that's coming. The other thing that's interesting, I think, that we're going to see in the next, well, we're seeing it now, but certainly over the next few years become more ubiquitous, is a lot of these tools are great at tracking stuff, right? Like, to your point, you track your sleep, you track your heart rate, you track all your biorhythms, all these things. But the pivot there is, what do you do with all that information? Like, what does it mean, right? So being able to use some of these AI models and some of these other learning tools, you know, these systems can now start to be like, what's normal for you and what's not normal for you? And what should you do about that? Maybe in real time, right? Where you talk about go to the doctor once a year and they give you like, hey, you should lose weight and you should do this, and you come back a year later and they check your blood pressure again, right? But now you have something that's checking thousands of things all the time, and you can start to learn, like, this is a normal thing. It might be abnormal for someone else, but it's actually maybe normal for you. And these might be indicators that something's up. Maybe you're not sleeping well. Maybe you're not eating well. Maybe you're not getting the same exercise you did before. Whatever it might be. But that starting to turn into more prescriptive types of things, instead of like, here's a report of the last 60 days, do what you will with this information. It might be, we've been collecting information over the last 60 days. You should do these things in order to improve these other things. And I think that's where the medical community will start to lean into that a lot more heavily too, as you start to connect these devices to your healthcare systems and things like this, where now you do have that. I think the legacy systems that they have make it harder to adopt this technology quickly, But I think everybody's looking at this to make sure that, you know, a doctor can thoroughly monitor a patient through a whole year, not just in that moment where they're checking your temperature one day.
That's encouraging to hear. So there's lots of companies you can go to have software developed. But to be successful, especially from a strategic perspective, and you all have obviously had lots of success, there's got to be something there that's giving you a competitive advantage. So, you know, in terms of what do you do differently? How is your culture different? How is your experience different? Or how do those combine to give you a unique competitive advantage in the marketplace?
Yeah, I'll take the culture piece of it. So I think our organization over the past, you know, probably 10 years has evolved like everyone else, every other organization. But we lean heavily into empathy as one of our, you know, core values, which is an extremely hard practice. Empathy and with each other, with our clients, and with that comes the follow-ons of communication, accountability, and these other, you know, tenets that ultimately lead to empathy. And I think we've got a team that practices that daily with each other and with our clients. And I think that's the first, you know, part of this, I think, that sets us apart.
Interesting. Well, there's a book called Creative Confidence, and it was written by the founders of the D School at Stanford, the design school. And a key part of effective design is empathy, you know, really trying to understand, put yourself in the shoes of the customer in that case.
You know, a lot of companies focus on the wrong things when they're building technology or using technology, which is just, can I make it work? Not necessarily am I making it work the right way, or even am I making it work for the right people? And so invariably what happens is you end up with a product that is not really built for anybody. It was just built to do something. And so, you know, when we look at things, we're always working with our clients to start there. Why do your clients even hire you in the first place? What do they expect from you? What are they trying to do? And how can we make that possible? And so taking that approach is very different than something like a dev shop. You know, that term gets thrown around a lot. And there are dev shops out there, teams of engineers waiting for you to call them and do work for them. But if you don't know what you're building, having a team of engineers is not terribly helpful, actually. And so for us, we've built our organization with, you know, leadership who's been through the ringer of startups and technology and building and shaping things for customers and knowing where some of the landmines are and what's really tricky. And also, how do you make sure you're listening to your customers and you're not just building the thing that you want or the thing you think your business needs, but the thing that your customer wants and that they need. And so when we bring in a team, you know, we spend sometimes weeks, sometimes months going through those cycles with customers, making sure they understand what value do you bring to your customer base and to the people you want to be your customers.
And those can be hard conversations. Once we've exposed everything, talked to all the constituents, the clients, you know, their customers, their, you know, the people within the company, and sometimes things aren't as they thought they were. And their customers actually come to them for something totally different.
Yeah,
they thought they were.
And there's one question that I ask a lot, especially if we're, you know, if we're at a crossroads somewhere, which many of the customers we're working with are. And it is kind of a tough question, but why does your customers even care that you exist? What value are you really bringing here? And that can be a very tough question for people to face, especially when they've just been business as usual for quite a while. And then you get to that point where you're like, why do your customers care that you still have the products you have or the services you have? Customer, I say, you're choosing not to make a good experience for me, and so I'm going to apply some judgment to that.
What are you all seeing in terms of integration of current technology with generative AI tools? Are you seeing, my sense is in talking to senior people at companies is many of them are still not, they wouldn't even know what I just said. That was possible. What are you seeing with that?
Well, we're certainly seeing, I think the point you bring up about training your own data using some kind of an AI tool is a really positive direction because you know the source of truth of that information. One of the things that's challenging with a lot of the tools we have today and a lot of the ones you described is the results you get, it's hard to tell what level of accuracy it is, or even is it accurate at all, or what was the source of the information in the first place. And so you're casting a pretty wide net with also a lot of uncertainty of the result you got, which could be totally wrong or could be totally right. You don't know.
But, I mean, students are getting into this problem because they trust it too much.
That's the interesting thing about it is we're at this infancy of this. Everybody has their theories of like, you know, we're going into, you know, Terminator days or this is going to change our lives for the good or whatever it may be. But I think that's going to be the one thing that shifts a lot, I think, you know, in the coming year or more is, you know, using these tools on data sets that we know to be good. And so it'll get better at answering the question correctly when it's using a set of data that's known and not just wherever it might cobble some of these things together. And so, you know, I think as you get, you know, certain industries, I mean, we all have interactions with chatbots and these things, and a lot of them are pretty poor. Those things could get considerably better with the right set of learning and training on that and get real useful, you know, feedback with complicated questions. I think that's where we'll start to see some of the early benefit. But then that internal use of, to your point, training on a set of known data that goes back maybe a long time and be able to mine and utilize that data in a way through, you know, the same way we do today with ChatGPT or others, but getting responses back that you could rely on in a much more credible way. And I think we might see some of that where being more transparent in the result, and it almost feels sometimes like when you talk to somebody who doesn't really know what they're talking about and they just give you a confident answer, and you're like, well, that's probably true. That seemed reasonable. And then you find out that it wasn't at all.
Yeah.
That's how a lot of these chat tools or the AI tools feel like, is that it gave me a very confident, plausible answer that if and because I know very little about the subject I was asking about, it seems believable. But it's really difficult to check that in any way. And so if you might use that for inspiration for more research and be like, okay, I'm gonna go learn and this is true. But not everybody's gonna do that. And then that's the risk of kind of where we're at, like at this moment, I think.
First of all, Josh and Jonathan, congratulations on the great success of Mentova. You know, it's encouraging to have a company here in Northwest Arkansas that's doing business all over the place, not just in Arkansas, and doing well. So congratulations, and thank you for taking time to visit with me.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
On behalf of the Sam M. Walton College of Business, I want to thank everyone for spending time with us for another engaging conversation. You can subscribe by going to your favorite podcast service and searching Be Epic. BEEPIC.